This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is the spring of 1900. Barnum Brown arrives in New York City from Patagonia. This is the tale of the search for the Tyrannosaurus Rex. The T-Rex, now displayed at the American Museum of Natural History, has a backstory and a wonderful new book, The Monster's Bones, The Discovery of T-Rex and How It Shook Our World. David K. Randall is the author. He works at Reuters, but in his day job, but in his night job, he travels like Arthur Conan Doyle and the scientist Challenger to search out the T-Rex, the origin of T-Rex, and how it is that we have T-Rex as the apex predator who ever lived on the planet Earth. David, congratulations and good evening to you, and thank you very much. Barnum Brown arrives from Patagonia, where he's been searching for bones. Immediately, he's turned around and sent back out by the American Museum of Natural History because there is a bones race, which I think of as a moon race or an Arctic race underway, between museums and collections. The Carnegie Museum and Andrew Carnegie himself, the American Museum of Natural History, the Field Museum, the Fields of Chicago, and Yale and Princeton. This race underway, it's been building for 70, 80 years. Is it always in the news, or are we just seeing something special that later explodes? Good evening to you, David.
Thank you for having me. So this was a time where dinosaurs were relatively new. The concept that, you know, the Earth had a much longer history than anyone had ever considered was still a very radical idea. And, you know, that analogy we're making to an Arctic expedition was very, very apt. You know, these people were going to essentially the blank spots on the map to bring back evidence of this almost alien life form. And the public ate it up. You know, when somebody found a new dinosaur or a very monstrous specimen, it was on the front page of newspapers, and the public couldn't get enough. So museums were quickly realizing that if they wanted to stay relevant and if they wanted to bring people in the doors, they needed dinosaurs as well. So it became both a competition between the museums to stay on the front page of newspapers, and a competition between the museum backers to say, you know, because of my generosity or because of my wealth, I was able to help find this amazing exhibit, and then therefore my personality, my history, my ego especially, is always going to be linked to this large monster.
Looking at the story from the point of view of the museums, it began to feel like it was Hollywood. You know, they need eyeballs, they need to bring them in, and they worry about the traffic. Now, this competition between museums, we need to mention that these are the richest men probably on planet Earth outside royalty, claiming all the sovereign powers of their territory. The backer of the American Museum of Natural History, which has been not a success at this point, is Rockefeller, Schiff, Peabody, and Huntington. Are they driving the story, or is that just the imagination of the museum directors? Do they get letters from Rockefeller saying, where are my bones?
To a certain extent, yes. So J.P. Morgan was another one of these backers. And he had been giving an equivalent of our money, millions of dollars, year after year to the American Museum, because one of his family members, Osborne, was the head of the paleontology division. And if it hadn't been for that family connection, he would not have continued giving money. He had bought a collection of diamonds that Tiffany's had put on display in Paris. And then he then donated it to the museum. And he found this so much easier. It was already, you know, the diamonds were there. It wasn't searching. It wasn't trying to go out and find something new. And who knows if you're going to bring it back or not. Then at the same time, Andrew Carnegie, he started donating and founded what we now know as the collection of Carnegie Museums in Pittsburgh. And one of his expeditions, they found a giant Diplodocus. I mean, all of the dinosaurs are giant, but this one was particularly large. And in honor of him, with the paleontologist who discovered it, named it after him. It was the Diplodocus Carnegie. So suddenly he had this essentially jewel in his crown that nobody else did. And so then, therefore, all of his competitors, the other, you know, major capitalists of their day, they wanted the same thing. It's almost the equivalent of now, you know, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk both want to get to space as quickly as they can. Back then, it was dinosaurs.
And we go now to go into action because David mentions Henry Osborne. He is a critical player here because he cracks the whip. Barnum Brown works for Henry Osborne. And what we need to know about Henry Osborne is that he resembles what Hollywood would imagine would be a villainous preppy 120 years ago, a man who is always anxious about how he is viewed in the world, that he has to earn his station every day. Of course, this leads him to being elitist and imperious and ruthless, and what we would regard as unacceptable prejudices. But 120 years ago, he commanded Barnum Brown to get back out there. So now we must get back out there with our hero. But before we send Barnum Brown out, at this point, the museum, the American Museum of Natural History, I picture it, David, standing by itself as a pillar of granite in the middle of nothing right around it, where there was barely an uptown at this point. Is that correct?
That's exactly correct. So it's on the edge of Central Park. There is pretty much nothing else around it. And in many ways, it's forgotten. You know, it's not connected to the city physically, and it's also not connected to the city socially. It's not a place where people feel like they need to go to. It's not a place where you spend a Sunday afternoon with your children like you do now. It's in a lot of ways, it was a boring collection of rocks. It wasn't something that, you know, mostly New York City is a city of immigrants. It's not something that made them feel connected and made them feel that science is a part of their lives in any meaningful way.
What was useful for the last 70 years was to find a bone and claim that it was connected to a monster. They used the word monster routinely, David. I was surprised by that. They didn't have the technical language, and they certainly didn't have the geology, and they didn't understand the ages of man. So much, sometimes I read it in the same problem with astronomy. They didn't know those fuzzy things were galaxies. But they were feeling their way through, and Barnum Brown is now going to be our guide to how it is not only that we have the T-Rex displayed at the American Museum of Natural History, but that we discover the world before the world. The book is The Monster's Bones, The Discovery of T-Rex and How It Shook Our World. David K. Randall is the author, and we're with Barnum Brown as he gets back out there to find something big that'll attract the crowds. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.